Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 12295, Hawaii State Teachers Association v. University Laboratory School. Ms. Rebecca Covert, arguing for the petitioner. Also appearing for the petitioner, Ms. Davina Lamb. Arguing for the respondent, Mr. Richard Thomason. Argument on the merits.
Good morning to both of our sets of counsel this morning. Are you both ready to proceed? Okay, and Ms. Covert, you've asked for a warning with 10 minutes to go and reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a yellow light when we get to that point in your argument. Mr. Thomason, we will warn you when there's 10 minutes to go in your argument. Ms. Covert, please proceed. Thank you.
I'd also note that we have present today Ray Camacho, who is the negotiation specialist for HSTA, and Bev Miller, who is the UNICEF director assigned to the University of School.
Thank you.
Thank you. The local school board for the University Laboratory School made a commitment twice to the HSTA that it would arbitrate grievances arising under agreements between HSTA and the local school board. And the first commitment came when it signed a memorandum of agreement when the school was converting from being run by the University of Hawaii to becoming a charter school under a local school board. It agreed that it would, that the master agreement, Board of Education and HSTA agreement that covers DOE school teachers and charter school teachers, that agreement would apply to the teachers now being employed by the local school board. And within that agreement is a binding arbitration agreement. The second commitment came in a supplemental agreement. And that agreement was reached by HSTA and the local school board when they met in May of 2010 to work out unique issues for the school that were not covered under the master agreement. And they included in their supplemental agreement an agreement to arbitrate disputes, grievances arising under the supplemental agreement. So that was a commitment twice. When an issue arose over the placement of the teachers into the master salary schedule, the HSTA filed a grievance. They filed a grievance for a violation, misapplication, or misinterpretation of the supplemental agreement. It pursued the grievance, but the employer refused to go to arbitration, and it was compelled to file a motion to compel arbitration in state court. Despite having made two commitments to arbitrate disputes, the circuit court did not compel arbitration, and as a result, for 3 years now, HSTA has not had the benefit of the agreement that disputes arising under the collective bargaining agreement will be arbitrated, and teachers have not been placed onto the salary schedule in a manner that was intended under the supplemental agreement. Just a little background on the salary schedule. A salary schedule under the master agreement places teachers into a salary range or salary amount based on two factors. And the first is classifications, that's educational. Do you have a master's, do you have a BA, bachelor's, do you have a doctorate degree? Did you get other additional education after you got one of those degrees? And that decides your classification. And then there are steps that move you up a little bit more in the salary schedule. And those steps come by negotiations between the Board of Education and HSTA. And they are not annual. The parties negotiate it in some years, and in some years they don't. And so the idea was, where do you place these teachers who were formerly called APT teachers under HGA agreement? Where do you place them now that they're HSTA teachers on this master salary schedule? And HSTA made a proposal in the bargaining in May of 2010 that you will put them into the salary schedule, which requires you identify their classification, their education, and then you will apply increment steps or step increments, and that will be based on negotiated step increments for Unit 5 members.
Suppose your request for arbitration had been granted, and the arbitrator disagreed with your position and said, you know, this exhibit wasn't part of the negotiations. It's the only pages that weren't initialed. It's not part of the agreement. Sorry, you folks lose. Would you be satisfied with that?
Well, no, we wouldn't be satisfied, because in the arbitration, we would have been presenting to the arbitrator what they are very familiar with, which is the bargaining history.
But it could happen.
It could happen.
Wouldn't that violate the Constitution? Because under the Constitution, aren't the terms supposed to be negotiated? I mean, isn't that why we have that? I almost feel like you're arguing a position that one would expect you to be on the other side of, because you're asking us to allow this to be decided, which seems to me something that should be negotiated. You're asking that an arbitrator decide it.
It was negotiated, though. So I think you're, due respect to your question, the legislature has indicated that back in 2000, they said that if there is a dispute over interpretation of language in a contract, it will be arbitrated.
But we all agree that it wasn't physically included. It's in a separate document, and the arbitrator could decide, sorry, this isn't part of the agreement, and the teachers lose.
The Exhibit 1, I think what you're drawing from, was not attached to the appendix. There is a question of fact as to whether or not it was given across the table. But the designation, which says where do you place these teachers into the salary schedule, states that for step placements, parties shall use the attached chart indicating negotiated step increments for Unit 5 members. What did the parties mean by negotiated step increments? And our point is, in HST's position, is what was expressed at the table in which the employer agreed to was it was negotiated steps that were negotiated between the Board of Education and HSTA over the years, and those years where increments were negotiated, they will apply to the teachers here. And that's a historical document. And whether it was attached or not, it is what it is. It was years it was negotiated or not.
I understand your argument, but my concern is that there's an equal argument on the other side, and you could be advocating a position that says we're going to have these terms arbitrated rather than negotiated, and that concerns me.
Well, I think that the problem in that is not to recognize that HSTA fashioned this grievance as a grievance, arbitrate a grievance, not as a interest arbitration type of matter. It fashioned its grievance to ask an arbitrator to find out what the parties meant in designation when both sides agreed that steps for salary placement, step placement would be decided by negotiated step increments. And then the question is, what did the parties intend by that? And we cited to you several cases coming out of the different circuits and the U.S. Supreme Court where they recognize that arbitrators, this is what they do.
Well, your position is that the terms of the contract have already been negotiated, right, under this master agreement. So was Exhibit 1 part of that master agreement?
In the sense of it's not a document that's attached to the master agreement either, but if you look at the memorandum of agreements that are negotiated every 2 years, or maybe they've had agreements last longer than 2 years between the Board of Education and HSTA, they would agree, okay, in the school year 2006 to 2007.
Well, so was it to be considered as part of the master agreement or as a supplement to the master agreement?
It would certainly be considered in a sense, a supplement to the master agreement because how a teacher will know where they sit in that salary schedule is dependent on what years were increments negotiated. And so that has to be part of a consideration in placing a teacher into the salary schedule, whether they're a DOE teacher or a new charter school coming in.
What should the arbitrator do if he or she concludes there was no meeting of the minds? You know, just through some incredible lack of communication, the union had one exhibit, the employer had another, and no one ever really agreed. What would the arbitrator do in that instance? Dismiss the grievance?
He probably would find that he could only find that there was no meeting of the minds and that the parties would have to negotiate. If he found that the concern that you're raising, that this was never negotiated, then he'll say that. He'll say, look, I've listened to your testimony. I've seen the document. I've read this document. I see negotiated step increments for Unit 5 members. I've listened to what your bargaining team has testified to. There's another section talking about recognizing years of service while you're at the charter, while you're at the under UH auspices. And I still just don't think you guys were on the same page. And so he would say
the appropriate disposition there would be dismissal because the arbitrator could not provide this material term that the parties had not agreed to. Is that correct?
That's correct. But what we're arguing to the court here is that it's not for the court to make that decision. It's not for the board to make that decision. The parties agreed that if a dispute arose over interpretation of the supplemental agreement, it would go to an arbitrator. And the legislature made that designation very clear in 2000 when it took several steps related to Chapter 89. And the first thing was it said that prior to 2000, it was optional if a public employer had a grievance arbitration provision in the contract. And it said, well, we're going to make it mandatory. And they moved it into that Section 89.10.88.
Did HLRB's ruling on the motion to dismiss preclude then any arbitration?
I do not believe it did. For one thing, it is they never gave the reasoning for it. Second, it's not a final decision. And then third, it is for the court on a motion to compel arbitration and for an arbitrator to decide whether or not the parties had an agreement.
I'm sorry, what was the effect of HLRB's ruling on dismissal? The motion to dismiss, what was the effect of that?
The effect was that the case continued in November of 2011. It never issued a written decision.
The prohibited practice complaint would proceed.
It proceeded. It was, I think you had some updates from the employer, but there was a hearing. We filed a motion for summary judgment in August of 2013. The employer had a motion filed for partial summary judgment. The court heard the the board heard the arguments on September 20th, 2013, and it took under, it heard the arguments on those motions. It found that there was not an answer filed in the case, so that the allegations were going to be considered as asserted, and parties were ordered to file briefs, and briefs were filed on October 21st, and no action has followed since the filing of that.
Well, let's and I realize that the union strongly disagrees with the employer's characterization of these events, but assuming that the employer's characterization was found to be correct and that there was no meeting the minds in this issue, would it be a prohibited practice for the union to refuse to bargain in good faith on this issue? If, as the employer asserts, we never reached agreement, it's a material term, it's pay, it's salary, we asked the union to negotiate, they refused to negotiate, is that something that's within the jurisdiction of the HLRB? And if the state of affairs are as the employer suggests, could that provide the basis for a prohibited practice finding? And if so, why would it be inappropriate for the court to defer to allow that to play out?
If the board found that, or some forum finds that there was no meeting of the minds, I think though the board would have to look whether or not HSD had a reasonable basis to believe that it had a violation arising under the collective bargaining agreement, and did it have a reasonable basis, despite any ruling to the contrary, that there was an agreement on salary placement involving step increments that was reached. And under the case law we've cited to you, both here at HLRB and in the Supreme Court and the NLRB, if a term is agreed to during the duration of the agreement, there is no duty to bargain. So I think the board would have to look at whether or not HST had a reasonable basis.
The board would be looking at whether or not there was a reasonable basis for the union's action. Going back to the motion to stay, whatever occurred on the motion to stay? The board took that under advisement.
The employer filed the motion to stay the arbitration proceeding, and it took that under advisement back in August of 2000.
What happened to that?
It never issued a ruling on that matter.
Any reason why?
It never
up to this point it has never issued a ruling?
No, they never gave any reason why.
Do they have jurisdiction over that question still?
I would submit that they do not have jurisdiction to stay an arbitration. I'm sure they disagree with that position, the board, but I think under 658A, whether arbitrations proceed or don't proceed, are matters to be handled under that chapter. That chapter would, the circuit court would have to address a motion and or decide if it goes to an arbitrator.
if we're sort of in a gray area between interpretation of a contract and negotiation of a contract, what, why not, or why is it an abuse of the discretion for the court to, in essence, defer its ruling while it allows the board to go ahead and bring its expertise to bear and see if that provides any information that's useful or relevant when the matter comes back before the court? Why not allow, because the board does have expertise, of course, in issues related to how collective bargaining is undertaken, how parties approach these matters, why not allow that expertise to be brought to bear?
Well, I don't agree that the expertise of the board are applicable here. And that's because this really is a question of what did the parties intend by that language in Appendix 14 of the supplemental agreement. And so, first off, 658A7.
Well, in a sense, expertise is not really at issue here, right? Because all you brought before the circuit court was a motion to compel arbitration. So the court itself would not be involved in the merits of the collective bargaining agreement or the supplemental agreement. Its sole purpose was to determine whether arbitration should proceed or not.
Right, under Bates.
So in that sense, it wouldn't be intruding on the expertise of the HLRB.
In that, from that perspective, too, it would not, because under Bateman and Bronster decisions.
And apparently these teachers have been going with, in some state of limbo for the last 3 years since the HLRB hasn't decided this issue.
That is correct.
But wouldn't the court have to make a decision before it sends the matter to arbitration? The court has to decide whether an agreement to arbitrate exists or the controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. So the court's going to have to make a call on whether or not, before it even goes over to arbitration, whether or not those terms are part of the agreement.
I don't agree that under the case law that has come up by this court in arbitration, that where the parties have agreed that arbitrability will be decided by the arbitrator, there's a two-part test that the court is supposed to consider in a motion to compel. Is there an enforceable agreement to arbitrate, and if so, 658A7 says you shall compel. The second question is the dispute. Is the dispute within the scope of the agreement to arbitrate? And under Bateman, and then even clearer under Bronster, this court has held that where there's an agreement to arbitrate, I'm sorry, where the agreement is that the arbitrator will decide issues of arbitrability, the court's role on a motion to compel is very limited to whether or not there is an agreement to arbitrate, and then it gives it to the arbitrator to decide that next question.
Except the difference is we have a statute here, and the statute says if the terms have to be, if it involves the terms of the agreement, it doesn't go to arbitration. We have a specific statute. That's why those cases, I'm not so sure, are persuasive.
Those terms, though, are going for an agreement that does not exist. It's when parties sit down and say, what should our agreement be? What should we put into this agreement? Shall we have a provision on seniority? Shall we have this provision?
Well, I thought the state said that that provision in the statute is limited to situations where you're starting to do collective bargaining. In other words, that it refers to an initial or renewed agreement. And does that apply to this particular agreement?
That's what we're saying, is that does not apply to this agreement, because there is a section in the supplemental agreement called salary placement, and this dispute is about salary placement.
Well, if you have a master agreement and you're making, and these teachers are simply because they now become a part of the system, no longer part of the university, they're just being shifted into that context where all other teachers are, aren't they? State teachers.
The question was how to move them. And under the memorandum of agreement, they were to keep their salaries as they had it at the UH.
In other words, you're not starting new with the teachers at this charter school.
No, they came in with a history. And they had some had been there for 15, 16 years teaching. And under HSTA, and under the master schedule.
So this provision that says a dispute with respect to the term shall not constitute a grievance would not apply in this case. At least that's your position. It seems to be the state's position, too.
Our position is that that language about a term for a new or a renewed agreement is talking have an agreement.
Go ahead.
The only thing I wanted to ask, I heard you say that you thought the fact that there was language in the supplemental agreement about salary placement was significant. Can you explain why you think the fact that that language is there is significant?
Because that is what the dispute is about. And so there is something, there is a term that exists in the supplemental agreement. And the party employer signed off on it. And if maybe it's a latent ambiguity, maybe it's a obvious ambiguity that the employer should have stopped and said, hey, wait a minute, what does negotiated step increment for Unit 5 members mean? But they signed off on that. What does it mean? And HSTA is saying it means the step increments that were negotiated with the Board of Education. And it's a term already existing in the agreement that the union is asking for an arbitrator to interpret.
So, I'm sorry, in terms of like a gray area between negotiation and interpretation, you think that language takes this over on the side of contract interpretation as opposed to some situation where the union just comes in and says, hey, you know, we talked over the table about there being a pay differential, and we reached agreement on that, and the employer goes, well, that's not even in the agreement. That situation might fall on the other side, but what you're saying is this situation, because there actually is language in the agreement about this matter, falls on the side of being interpretation. Is that right?
I certainly, yes, and that there is an agreement. And I think if you, and I'll take a little bit longer just to
sure.
make one point that if what this court finds is that this is something that could is an initial term, almost, I can't say every grievance, but we have grievances that the HSTA and other unions file all the time based on their interpretation of what that language in a contract means. And the employer's answer to that is, you're creating some term in the agreement we never agreed to. And so if every time the union interprets a language one way, and the employer says, we don't interpret that way, that's a new term, you're creating a new term we never agreed to, we're at HLRB all the time. And in 2000, the legislature not only made arbitration mandatory to be in every collective bargaining agreement, but took the board out of being involved in negotiations, grievances and arbitration.
Are you making a distinction then that this agreement is not an initial or renewed renewal?
Well, the agreement itself, the supplemental agreement was a new agreement and it contained terms in it.
So you're not making the argument it's not covered by that, I mean, because supplemental means anything added to complete something, so it's either part of the initial or it's a renewed agreement.
Well, in charter schools, you have they'll come under the master agreement, which is the Board of Education agreement, and then they can negotiate supplemental agreements. So I think that's a question which I'm not really addressing here, and I don't want to slip into saying something that later okay. I might not agree with myself. What they mean by new or renewed and whether that applies to the master agreement or to supplemental agreements.
Well, that's why I asked you whether this was part of the master agreement which pre-existed and that these teachers were just being shifted into a situation where other teachers were already situated, because the statute says that dispute over the terms of an initial or renewed agreement shall not constitute a grievance. So if you read the statute with your contract, that would mean that this would not go to arbitration because it's not a grievance. But you claim it is a grievance and therefore should go to arbitration. So I'm not sure if your answer to Justice Pollack, in fact, disagreed with what I thought you had said originally, that this was not an initial renewed agreement because of the existence of the master agreement.
I think it's not the grievance is not over creating a new a term in a new grievance over an existing term in an existing supplemental agreement. I don't know if that answers your question either, but.
Yeah, well, my question then is, because supplemental means something that's added to complete something, it seems to me it's integrated and it's part of the initial agreement. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Mr. Thompson now.
Good morning. I'd like to make a few things clear.
I just wanted to ask you one question, Mr. Thomason. Assuming the court does not exercise jurisdiction over whether or not an arbitrator should be appointed, where would we be before the HLRB with respect to arbitration at this point?
The HLRB is going to rule on two issues. One is whether or not...
Would you answer my question first? Where would we be on the question of the arbitration agreement? Assuming there is here an arbitration agreement, it's been 3 years,
yes,
and you have a stay out there outstanding, and I assume the school and the teachers and the state are still in a state of limbo. What happens then?
The HLRB must rule.
Excuse me?
We've already briefed it. We've already briefed all the issues.
The HLRB must rule?
Yes.
3 years have passed. Why must it rule? It hasn't ruled.
Well, we've already submitted all of our briefing. We've already had all of our arguments.
You've done what you're supposed to do. My question is, the HLRB hasn't ruled.
Yes.
It hasn't ruled for 3 years. And so the court steps in and says, well, I assume the practical effect of this is that status quo remains.
Yes.
It hasn't ruled, and we don't know when it will ever rule.
That's correct.
So why shouldn't the court then exercise its discretion?
Well, it should not exercise its discretion to proceed with the grievance until the predicate issues as to whether or not the grievance is allowable under our statutes has been decided. Because if you don't, then you're having an arbitrator decide prohibited practices or whether or not the parties are involved in a bargaining dispute. And with regard to the bargaining dispute issue, it's clear to me, and it's clear to my office, is that our position on what 8910.81A is that you cannot grieve bargaining disputes. If you have a dispute over whether or not something actually got bargained, you don't grieve it. Otherwise,
couldn't the arbitrator then just say this? The issue before the circuit court is whether or not there was an agreement to arbitrate.
Yes.
And our case law is very clear that when the parties agree that the issues of arbitrability are left to the arbitrator, it's for the arbitrator to decide. So in this case, the arbitrator, if we rule that arbitration, there is an agreement to arbitrate, the arbitrator could well decide that this is not arbitrable. The arbitrator, then I'm sure somebody would be appealing, but the arbitrator could decide it is arbitrable. And then when there's a motion to confirm, you would then challenge it on the grounds that this violates public policy or whatever challenge that you might have.
Yes.
But the only issue before us right now is whether or not there was an agreement to arbitrate, correct?
No. The main issue before you right now is whether or not it's appropriate for an arbitrator to interpret and imply and apply Chapter 89. And it's not. It's not with regard to claims of prohibited practices. It's not with regard to claims of the duty, the statutory duty to bargain in good faith. And it's not within his purview to interpret or apply 8910.8.
Mr. Thomason, do you agree that there is an agreement to arbitrate?
Grievances, yes. Not statutory stuff.
Now, once you agree that there is an agreement to arbitrate, doesn't Bronster say, I understand your argument is it's not arbitrable, but isn't that up to the arbitrator to decide that it's not arbitrable?
In the Bronster case, I agree that that was acceptable. But in this case, we have an intervening statute that was not present in Bronster. And that statute, and you interpret it, says that only one entity can have a primary jurisdiction over prohibited practices and statutory violations, and that's the HLRB. All we're saying is that the HLRB gets to look at the predicate issues. If the HLRB interprets 10.8 in a manner that's different than us, that's fine. It gets arbitrated. But the point is they get first crack. And whether or not they're slow or not is not dispositive to the issue of whether or not it's appropriate to have an arbitrator decide statutory issues involving Chapter 89.
What's your answer to Ms. Covert's argument that you can always, there will constantly be disputes about whether the parties reached agreement on a particular term. They had different things in mind. You know, I thought it meant this, you thought it meant that. I thought vacation days meant this, you thought it meant that. Every time there's a dispute like that where there's an argument that the parties had different understandings of a contract term, it's going to go to HLR. You think that's what the legislature intended?
No, it's not what they intended, but the obverse is true also, which is that if you're not supposed to have grievances over bargaining disputes, it would be too easy for the union to simply say every single time, yeah, we did negotiate that, we just forgot. Therefore, we get to escape HLRB's scrutiny over whether or not 10.8 applies and go and grieve every single type of bargaining dispute under the sun. Bargaining disputes are not supposed to be grieved. They're supposed to be bargained, and only the HLRB can order the parties to go back to bargaining.
Well, it's your characterization that there's a bargaining dispute.
Yes.
I guess the union's characterization is that this stuff has all been bargained.
Yes,
previously. Otherwise Exhibit 1 would not exist, I assume. Does Exhibit 1 apply to other teachers?
No.
Doesn't apply to any teachers?
Doesn't apply to other teachers at DOE or anywhere else.
So where does Exhibit 1 come from?
It applies, Exhibit 1, assuming it were actually ever properly negotiated, would apply to the transferees who came from HGEA or UPA and became Unit 1 members. It's supposed to apply to them. In this case, this is the first time I've ever filed a motion with another entity other than an arbitrator to determine issues of arbitrability. I've had 50 arbitrations, many of them Ms. Covert. I'm experienced when dealing with these sort of things. The fact pattern in this case was very unique. We had all of the initial settlement negotiations, bargaining negotiations that took place, every single page of every single document that became the supplemental agreement was initial, except this one. The union put together the final supplemental agreement. They edited it, they printed it, and they distributed it. That exhibit's not in there. That's a very strong fact pattern.
If that's strong, then what's the problem with going to arbitration?
Because it's
that's just a fact. The arbitrator would arbitrate.
He cannot rule on our claims that this is a bargaining dispute. It's in violation of 89.10.8, and he can't.
Why not? Isn't that an issue of arbitrability? Wouldn't he
be
able to say,
you
know what, this is not subject to arbitration?
89.14 says that the HLRB has primary jurisdiction over statutory duties. One of those duties is the duty to bargain in good faith.
Couldn't the
arbitrator please let the justice finish her question.
Couldn't the arbitrator just rule, as you are arguing, that, you know what, this is not subject to arbitration?
I think the HLRB has primary jurisdiction over
so
that question.
Can you answer my question? Couldn't the arbitrator just rule this is not subject to arbitration? Don't arbitrators sometimes rule?
I'm sorry, I should have asked
in labor disputes?
Yes.
Right.
Well, you would have to read 89.14 with, I guess it's 89-10.8 then, right?
Yes.
Because 89.14 says the board shall have exclusive jurisdiction over prohibited practices. But on the other hand, 89-10.8 says that, and I guess the legislature commanded that a public employer shall enter into a exclusive, shall enter into an agreement setting forth a grievance procedure culminating in a final and binding decision. So that, at least in that sense, the legislature carved out an area in which the exclusive jurisdiction of the board would be subject to this grievance arbitration procedure.
With the proviso that you cannot have a grievance over a bargaining dispute. They retained that within the statute. That means they retained the HLRB's jurisdiction to look at that first, not an arbitrator.
If that were true, can you tell me why the state agreed to the provision in the contract that says if the employer, meaning I guess your client, disputes the arbitrability of any grievance submitted to arbitration, the arbitrator shall first determine the question of arbitrability. If the arbitrator finds that it is not arbitrable, the grievance shall be referred back to the parties without decision or recommendation on its merits. Doesn't that provision apply here?
It applies, but the answer to your question is that if you look at 8914, and if you look at 8910.8, our position is that you cannot interpret any arbitration clause in the public sector as being broad enough to include the authority to decide either prohibited practices or violations or grievances over the over bargaining disputes.
The state could just as well have not agreed to leave the issue of arbitrability to the arbitrator. Most arbitration agreements don't leave issues of arbitrability to an arbitrator, at least in the commercial sector. So, but the state agreed to leave it to the arbitrator. So let me ask you, if we compel, we find that there is an agreement to arbitrate, and we remand this matter for an arbitrator, and the arbitrator rules that the issues are arbitrable and addresses the merits and issues an arbitration award, HSTA moves, and obviously the state disagrees, and so HSTA moves to confirm the arbitration award. What would the state's remedy be at that point?
They would have to reach the overcome the incredibly difficult burden of convincing a court to overrule the arbitrator by stating that he exceeded his jurisdiction. It's a very, very high bar.
Does anything in the statute mean anything when it says the arbitrator's decision, according to the legislature, shall be final and binding? Is there any appeal from that ruling?
Well, we deal with appeals in the form of motions to...
I'm sorry, final and binding. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Final and binding is pretty illusory with regard to arbitrations, because we deal with motions to vacate arbitrations all the time. And they get appealed all the way up to where they end up.
Has this court ever set aside an arbitration award on the grounds of public policy?
Lower courts have.
Isn't that what you would be arguing? Wouldn't you be arguing that it violates public policy?
And that he exceeded the scope of his authority.
Wouldn't that be the proper time for this court to be addressing any issues that you are raising here?
No. The proper time would be when the HBIRB rules on the predicate issues, and whichever party is unhappy with the decision.
So you're saying that you agree with a trial court's decision on primary jurisdiction, correct?
Yes.
Now, I think Justice Ocopo was asking that, were the briefs actually completed in 3 years ago, the briefing in this case?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
No. The final briefing was only completed last 3 weeks ago.
Three weeks ago. Okay. And is there a hearing set, or what's the process there?
They are going to rule. I expect a prompt ruling.
Mr. Thomason, haven't appellate courts here regarding the doctrine of primary jurisdiction stated that it applies to a claim that is originally cognizable in the courts, but which requires the resolution of issues that are within the special competence of an administrative agency. Was this matter originally cognizable in the court?
The issue that was, yes, and the issue that was cognizable for the court was whether or not to compel arbitration using the two-prong analysis. So the court had primary jurisdiction over that. The HBIRB has primary jurisdiction over the predicate. I say the predicate. People can disagree, but I say that those are predicate claims that the school has that go to the same issue, the veracity of whether or not Exhibit 1 was properly negotiated.
Okay, if the gravamen of this issue is whether Exhibit 1 was properly negotiated or whether there was an agreement of the meeting of the minds, why do you need special competence of an agency to make that determination?
You need the special competence in
intelligence of the HLER, because we have statutory claims with regard to the statutory duty to bargain and also the interpretation and application of 10.8. In looking at those issues, and if you look at the Del Monte case, the board will look at the totality of the circumstances. It's not like they're going to get hung up on looking at issues that are within the 90-day deadline to file. But the board is well equipped to look at exactly those issues. An arbitrator could look at those issues if there weren't superseding statutory considerations that are reserved for the HLER. That's what's novel about this case.
The motion to stay arbitration has been pending for 3 years. So in fact, the board hasn't made a decision on whether arbitration should proceed or not for 3 years. And that's the point at which, I guess, the circuit court has come into the picture. So by proceeding with the Prohibited Practice Act, has the board, in effect, decided the arbitration question?
No.
How can it reach the Prohibited Practice Act claim, that is, that the union bargained in good faith, if it doesn't first determine whether or not the grievance applied to a bargaining issue or not?
I don't think they have to look at the grievance at all. They simply look at the behavior of the parties.
Let me ask you this. If the board comes up and says there was bad faith bargaining, what happens to the arbitration issue?
The arbitration issue, there would be nothing left to arbitrate.
So in effect, the board has decided that by not deciding it and proceeding with the Prohibited Practice Act.
Prohibited Practice Claim. The board is going to rule on all of the statutory claims that the school has brought, which will, of course, encompass all of the claims that are contained in the grievance. If the board says that you can't...
That will, in effect, preclude any arbitration proceeding. Right?
Certainly.
So, in effect, it has, by proceeding this way, circumvented the arbitration issue, or at least decided it implicitly.
Well, can't they decide against you? Then it would go to arbitration.
Yes. There's no dispute that if they decide against us, we're going to arbitration. And your character...
But they have the motion to stay arbitration before them. They've had it for 3 years, so the possibility or probability of that is slight, isn't it? In fact, very slight, because they're proceeding with a prohibited practice complaint.
You know, I filed that motion for stay, and I've looked at a lot of case law since then, and I think it's questionable whether the board has jurisdiction to stay an arbitration decision.
Are you serious? You filed that motion to stay on the good faith belief that the board could give you a remedy, and now you're telling us that you don't think they had the jurisdiction?
I did not say I do not think. I said I'm not entirely certain.
You're not. And did you make that representation to the board, that you told the board, I'm filing this motion to stay, gentlemen and ladies, but I'm not really sure if you have the power to do that?
On two occasions, the board has granted motions to stay arbitration decisions.
Okay.
And I went off of that.
What's your response to Ms. Covert's argument that the agreement that was signed appears to reflect an intent or an agreement with regard to the salary issue, albeit that Exhibit 1 is left out, and because the agreement that was in fact signed by both sides appears to reflect a resolution of this issue, that we're in the territory of an arbitrator deciding the conflicting views of the party as to what that meant, as opposed to the extreme case in the other direction of, for example, a union simply asserting that something was in the agreement, that there's absolutely nothing in the agreement to indicate it was ever negotiated, talked about, or ever agreed to?
I think there's no dispute that everybody agreed that there was going to be an Exhibit 1 that listed how these people were going to be plugged into the system. But that doesn't mean that
Was there a competing Exhibit 1 that was presented by the state?
There were various proposals as to how to do this plug-in procedure. They differ fairly significantly, and the union's proposal would have a significant impact upon the schools.
But the state of affairs is there's documents that the employer would say were what they agreed to, and there's documents that the union would say was agreed to. Why isn't that typical grist for an arbitrator's mill?
I think it might be if there were not superseding statutory considerations in this particular case because of the uniqueness of Chapter 89.
So if we're in federal labor law, it would go to arbitration, but not here.
It's quite possible, I agree.
So what was the state of the contract then? So at the time when the contract was finalized, there was then some matter missing then, as represented by Exhibit 1?
Yes.
So was it incomplete contract?
Yes.
And how could the parties proceed on an incomplete contract?
Status quo.
The contract provided for that?
That's a simple labor law term that has many meanings, but as far as what happened procedurally, if that's what you're asking, the school ended up implementing a variation of, I'm really not sure exactly how they fashioned what they imposed, but they actually gave step movements that were larger than if you had simply gone to the master agreement. They're actually were more generous than that, which gets to your question as to whether or not the master is somehow controlling here. I don't think either party is arguing that the master agreement's methodology of doing step movements is what's should be in place or is in place.
But, you know, I come back to the question I asked you early on, which is, you know, Ms. Covert raises the point that, you know, anytime there's a dispute between the parties about what a term means, does that mean that this is going to be a subject that's going to go to HLRB? And assuming that that is not what the legislature intended, you know, you're going to have to look at the facts of the situation. I guess the district court, circuit court, has to exercise some discretion in whether it applies the doctrine. And in this circumstance where you, at least the agreement reflects an indication of agreement on this issue, was it an abuse of discretion for the court to decide to defer in these circumstances?
Absolutely not, because it's clear, I think, to everyone involved that there's very strong evidence that wasn't disputed, that this document was not bargained for, and that the best body to adjudicate how to deal with that was the HLRB. And we already had a situation where the HLRB had accepted jurisdiction over those very questions.
So the employer has fashioned some form of payment adjustment that it's been making pending the resolution of this dispute,
yes,
although different from the Exhibit 1 advanced by the union.
Yes.
Representatives from the state didn't notice there wasn't Exhibit 1 either, right?
No.
And it wasn't until the union came by later and said, oh, we forgot Exhibit 1 that the state noticed also. Okay.
Isn't really the only issue is what is the actual Exhibit 1?
From our perspective, the issue is that Exhibit 1 was never negotiated. Our perspective is not that the parties agreed to our what we thought was going to happen or what they thought was going to happen. If this particular issue fell through the cracks, the school came to the union and said, okay, look. This.
So you're saying that the parties signed an agreement say that it shall be as per Exhibit 1, but there wasn't never any agreement as to what Exhibit 1 was?
Precisely.
But didn't you come up with an alternative Exhibit 1?
Actually, what they did, now that I think about it more, is they simply, You know what? I better not speculate. I'm not sure exactly what they're... Obviously, they had...
Were you involved in the negotiations?
No. What they had, they already had something in place.
They meaning the state?
Yes. And, of course, one of the other aspects of the supplemental agreement, which is very important, is one of the keystones of it is that we red-circled everybody, so nobody got less pay by transferring to become a Unit 5 member. So that got implemented exactly how, I'm not sure. But it was in place during negotiations. I think they just simply proceeded with leaving it that way until this dispute was dealt with.
Okay, I want to come back to the question. I keep asking the question and rephrase it and see if it makes sense to you. It cannot be that any time the parties disagree about what a term in a contract means, that it goes to HLR. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes.
Okay. How do we distinguish the garden variety? We never thought that, you know, vacation pay differential or night pay differential meant what you said it meant, union or employer, from this situation.
Because in this situation, we had bargaining over an initial agreement, and then we had a situation where a key component of it never was placed into the agreement that was actually handed out, nor did we have any documents showing the initial approval of the union's version. That's a very unique fact pattern. If it comes up again, the same thing will happen, but it's a unique fact pattern. It's never come up in any of my cases, and I've done a lot.
What about the fact that the contract appears to reflect agreement on this issue? Does that matter? That was Ms. Covert's
point. It's simply an agreement that the parties would negotiate a method of plugging these teachers into the salary schedule.
Is there no further questions from the court? Anything further from you, Mr. Thomason?
No.
Thank you very much. Ms. Covert.
In the line of the just questions that follow, I would direct the court to look at the page 64 of the Record on Appeal. That is where the employer made a representation that they thought Exhibit 1 that they were signing off on was page 61 of the master agreement, which was the salary schedule. In another letter from the school, and you'll find that on page 143 of the Record on Appeal, they said they thought Exhibit 1 was a 3x3 grid, and that's what they thought. So to say here that they thought now it meant that it was going to be something they were going to negotiate in the future is contrary to what's in the record. I think the second thing to consider is that the reason the school doesn't want to go to arbitration is because they have to pay an arbitrator. They do not pay the HLIB, they do not pay the AG, but if they go to arbitration, they have to pay an arbitrator. So they don't want to go to arbitration.
Are you saying that the state actually conceded that there was an agreement and the only issue was what was the agreement? Because that's not the position that the state is taking here.
I'm just saying that they gave three reasons. Actually, I couldn't find the third one while I was waiting. They gave three reasons what they thought the Exhibit 1 was. And we're saying that that's the kind of thing an arbitrator looks at. The arbitrator says, okay, you went into bargaining, you thought...
Did the state ever take the position before this that this was Exhibit 1 was to be negotiated in the future?
I did not see that they took
it. Isn't that what the state just argued here today? That it was not? It was something to be negotiated?
I heard him say that there was something.
Right, that's what I heard him say.
There was actually a proposal by the union that there be a committee that would decide where you place the teachers, and that committee would look at the classification and would look at the years of service and figure it out. And they said, no, let's get rid of that part of your proposal. Let's have it just arbitrate that issue.
Does the HLRB have the power to compel arbitration?
I don't know that they can. They have the remedy under 377-9D. And it's to make whole, is when I usually see the language, so I have not.
I guess what I'm asking is, if you have situations like this, then does the question of arbitration or not, inevitably have to take the form of a prohibited practice complaint?
It should not.
Could the union have move to dismiss the prohibited practice complaint on the grounds that this is just a grievance arbitration?
We did make a motion to dismiss.
And what did HLUIP do?
They denied that motion.
Did they give reasons?
No.
And did I hear you correctly that you said that the reason for this lawsuit is all because the state was trying to avoid the cost of an arbitrator?
I'm sorry, I get a little excited about that issue. But that is the truth, that this school is saying that some of the other things you'll find in the record on appeal are that they said, we can't afford to pay this now. And that was at least a statement that was being made to the teachers, that we can't afford the type of placement in the salary that HSTA is saying we agreed to. And so they have the financial concerns. And I am saying that it is a fact that a charter school does not have to pay to go to HLRB. They get the attorney general without cost to their budget, but if they go to arbitration, they have to pay for an arbitrator.
But I thought I just heard that this is one of the few times or only times something like this has ever been filed, and all these matters, typical grievances, always go to arbitrators.
They do go, and we're talking about mostly the Department of Education, which has a much bigger budget.
So you're saying that you know that this arbitration costs would come out of the budget of the charter school, that school?
Unless they have some other arrangement with the DOE.
I see.
Or the Board of Education. You know, a couple of times the opposing counsel argued that grievances about bargaining disputes do not go to arbitration. That's pretty much what every contract interpretation grievance is about. That we agreed to one thing in the language and you think it means something else. And so in bargaining, we thought you meant this, we thought you meant that. And that's what the arbitrators then have to decide. So I agree that the court is looking and saying, is this a gray area? And I would also say that the legislature has said that if there's a presumption that if there's an agreement to arbitrate, that a dispute is arbitrable. And so if there is a gray area, I think the court needs to rule if you find that there is a gray area, then under the presumption that if there's an agreement to arbitrate, the court needs to compel the arbitration.
If this were to go to arbitration and you and the arbitrator said, yes, I can negotiate this, this is a grievance, calls it, characterizes a grievance, says it's not part of the agreement, you folks lose, would you come to the circuit court and try to vacate it for lack of jurisdiction?
If the arbitrator ruled against us and said that there was no meeting of the minds, it's hard to say because of the standard is whether or not the arbitrator, he or she, exceeded their authority. And if they're interpreting the language, it might be very difficult to show that they were exceeding their authority. And if they find that based on all the factors we're saying, it would be difficult to overturn that.
What if this court were to rule that there should have been an order compelling arbitration? An arbitrator is appointed, and the arbitrator and HLR issue simultaneous conflicting decisions.
I was ready for the other question where HLR ruled earlier, and I would have said that would be something an arbitrator could take into consideration, but not necessarily be controlling. And there's also an ability to an appeal an HLRB decision, and so it would not have res judicata effect. If they both came out at the same time, I think we would find ourselves in circuit court, perhaps, on that issue. I think my time is up. Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you very much. The court appreciates the arguments of counsel this morning. We'll take this matter under advisement. Thank you.